From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Yesterday, Lieutenant Governor Stratton threatened Illinois citizens with at least a 20% across the board income tax increase if their cherished tax increase hike amendment fails in November. That 20% comment is just a starting point and is just the beginning if you believe her. The intimidation and scare tactics used yesterday against Illinois citizens, employers, employees, retirees are a clear sign of desperation by the governor, Lieutenant Governor, Speaker Mike Madigan, because their tax hike amendment is failing and the election is around the corner.
That's the Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin speaking Friday morning. Illinois voters have been casting ballots this week, and here in Illinois there's a big question on the ballot whether or not to change from the flat tax to one that has higher rates for those earning more money. It's been in the news this week as the administration hinted that a big tax hike will be needed if that constitutional amendment fails. We'll talk about that and more coming up here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and our panel, again practicing social distancing from his home, we have Charlie Wheeler. He's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also with us, we have Hannah Meisel. She's a reporter now covering state government and politics for NPR Illinois, and it's good to have you back on with us, Hannah.
Glad to be here.
And from WBEZ, Michael Puente, who covers parts of Chicago and northern Indiana. And Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll get to some Indiana news here in just a little bit, but let's start with that key issue that's before Illinois voters this fall, the graduated income tax. Governor J.B. Pritzker and Democrats, they want to change the state constitution from a flat income tax rate to the graduated rates, known as a progressive tax by some, and those who make more would pay more. The issue was back in the spotlight, as I mentioned, as Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton said, if this doesn't get approved to bring in more money for the state of Illinois, expect an income tax hike of up to 20%. Hannah, this seemed like a calculated move. Your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the governor's signature policy proposal. He's been he started campaigning on it way back in 2017. And, you know, this is even before COVID, you know, it's not like Illinois' finances were doing super well. And so this was, you know, supposed to be the silver bullet to, get Illinois on track to a more stable fiscal footing. And so, you know, if this COVID, of course, has thrown all kinds of wrenches into it. Of course, our state finances are even in even worse shape than they were. And also, you know, even though the governor himself is spending, millions of dollars on campaigning for this through two external groups that are, you know, handling the advertising and the voter outreach, it's still not necessarily in the forefront of people's minds as, you know, we're 6 months into this pandemic. And so, the governor has been warning for, more than a year, frankly, about the prospect of cutting the budget, cutting services. But, it does seem, you're right, like a calculated move for Lieutenant Governor yesterday to say, you know, it's possible that we could actually raise income taxes on everyone. And 20% percentage increase would, in effect, raise the state's flat personal income tax from 4.95%, which where it has been for the past several years, to almost 6%. It's giving voters a choice in saying, like, okay, either raise taxes on rich people, those rich people, or everyone has to share the burden. And of course, they're banking on the fact that people will, tap into that, kind of inherent enmity toward the very, very wealthy. I mean, for the last decade, at least, we remember in 2011, we saw those Occupy Wall Street movement. I mean, it's died down, but it's also become honestly more part of the mainstream that people look at the very, very wealthy and say, well, how did, why are you allowed to be so wealthy when we're just scraping by here?
Well, Charlie, do you think that this was done, as a calculated move, a strategic move to get this discussion going, to get this issue back in front of people?
I guess in a way it could be. And I look at it maybe a little more academically, and I look at it being sort of a logical conclusion, just part of the mathematics involved. As a matter of fact, last year when the debate was going on about should we propose this amendment to change the flat rate provision in the state constitution to allow a progressive rate, some people pointed out at the time that if we don't do this, we're going to have to raise taxes across the board on everyone. And so part of the selling point has been, hey, if you vote for this, chances are, unless you're making more than $250,000 a year, and as we all know, most Illinoisans don't make more than that, you're going to pay the same or less. What? And so now we're seeing, and the alternative will be, as the governor said a couple of weeks ago, we're going to have to cut severely. And now the lieutenant governor says, or we're going to have to raise the tax across the board for everybody. And part of the difficulty is it's really hard to find places to cut that amount of money. I checked out the budget report put out by the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability the other day. And if we were to totally eliminate two branches of government, the court system and the legislature, and not spend one penny on judges, not spend one penny on senators or representatives or all the staff, we only save about $750 million out of a $40 billion budget. And obviously, we're not going to eliminate one of the branches of government. We spend our money, we spend it on things like education, health care, human services, and people, I don't think, would want those cut to the extent that you would have to cut them. Now, a lot of the people who are pushing against the progressive tax say, well, we should cut pensions. That's not going to happen because to do it, for starters, you'd have to pass a constitutional amendment, which can't be considered for 2 years. Then you'd have to get it through the courts. And we're talking about the need to do a budget next spring. We can't wait around for a constitutional amendment to eliminate the pension guarantee and the ensuing court cases to be decided. So I think it's, as I said at the beginning, it's simple math. Either you increase the tax on the super rich among us, or you increase it on everybody.
Well, let's turn to Indiana, Michael. You're up there in northern Indiana, where there is a flat tax in effect, and also a flat tax that is lower than what Illinois currently charges. Is this issue about a graduated tax in the neighboring state of Illinois getting any attention there?
Any discussion that talks about raising taxes anywhere in Illinois, Indiana loves. We know that. I mean, in Northwest Indiana, we get Chicagoland news and information, TV news. So we see all the ads that J.B. Pritzker is running and all the counter ads. So we're just taking it. And my kids are always saying, "What does this affect us?" No, it does. It does. It only affects us in the sense that if the more people get frustrated with Illinois' finances, that just means more people moving to areas of northern Indiana, northwest Indiana, and they are doing it in droves.
Hey, Michael, I have a question for you. My understanding is that unlike Illinois, Indiana has local income taxes. Is that still the case?
Well, yeah, there is local property taxes.
No, I'm talking about income taxes.
Income taxes, like a countywide tax, there is that. If some, not all counties have their own sort of sales tax, but Lake County, Indiana, certainly does, and I believe Porter County does.
Yeah, the reason I ask is because some years ago I did an analysis comparing tax rates around, and at the time Indiana's flat rate was lower than ours, but when I took in the local income tax, people who lived in Indianapolis would actually be paying more of their income over to the state and city than here in Illinois, where we don't have local income taxes.
I think that might be true. But at the same time, when you factor in everything, especially the property taxes, it just doesn't, compare at all. I mean, in Northwest Indiana, like say, for example, in some of the southern suburbs of Illinois, you have homes that are maybe worth $200,000 paying $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a year in property taxes. A comparison home just across the border, still in the Chicagoland area, you're paying not even half that. So a lot of people are seeing, yes, maybe in the income tax area, maybe some of the county taxes, it may be a little bit higher or lower than Illinois, but when you add it all up with taxes, there's no comparison. In the terms of, you end up paying more in taxes in Illinois than you do in Indiana.
And Hannah, how difficult is it going to be for the governor and supporters of this issue? Again, they have to get 60% approval to change the state constitution. But when you start talking taxes, not everybody's always looking at the fine details on this. And most people will just vote against anything with the word tax in it. Have you seen anything or heard anything regarding, you know, polling or what support seems to be for this right now?
I haven't seen any recent polls. I can't remember, honestly, the last time I saw a poll on this, but I know that there is internal polling going on all the time. You know, both groups are very well funded, have, you know, political veterans at their helms. Actually, I should say that on the anti-tax side, there's actually quite a few groups, but the one that's been leading the charge is headed by Greg Bays, who's the former head of the Illinois Manufacturers Association and, you know, worked in Republican politics for many years. Anyway, I know that, you know, it's very tricky. As you said, you know, once people see the word tax, they say, oh my God, I don't want to be subject to that tax. And that's why the people on the pro graduated income tax side have been very careful with their messaging, you know, careful every time to mention, you know, it would, if you are in the bottom 97% of income earners in Illinois, which would be most people that you and I know, you know, your tax would be either go down or stay the same. And of course, the people on the anti-graduated tax side say, actually, well, I mean, it would be so minimal, the amount of tax, the amount that your taxes would go down, especially as like maybe a middle to upper middle income earner. But yeah, I mean, both sides are being very, very careful with their language. I'm sure that a lot of people have made up their minds, and, you know, early voting started yesterday as we're speaking here on Friday. But there are still people, I'm sure, who are in the middle trying to decide. In the next 40 so days will be very, very important for both sides' advertising campaigns. And I'm sure that most people across the state have seen at least a few from both sides, and they're spending a lot, and it's going to get even more heated until November 3rd.
And it won't be the last time we talk about this issue leading up to the election. You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Michael Puente from WBEZ. Michael, I mentioned that you're based in Northwest Indiana, and you do a lot of reporting there as well as some in Chicago. But I wanted to take a look at some changes that are coming to Indiana this weekend regarding COVID-19 restrictions. Can you give us an update? What will be allowed? What's not going to be allowed starting this weekend?
Well, yes. Well, they're going to be moving Indiana to what's called stage 5 of the last stage. But at the same time, it's not going to be business as usual. People are still going to be recommended to wear a facial mask, continue to do the social distancing. Now, restaurants are going to be open, what Governor Eric Holcomb has said, at full capacity. But even with that, they're still going to have to comply with the social distancing. So it's not going to be a full pack restaurant like before, like last summer or before the pandemic hit. There's still going to be seating area that is going to be still somewhat limited. It's going to be less than full capacity. So we're entering this stage 5 because Indiana says their positivity rate is right around 4%. That's great news. But at the same time, we're still getting new positive cases. Just today, it's over 1,100. So you've got people are wondering, why is this happening now? It's leading up to an important election. Governor Eric Holcomb is running for a re-election. It's right now not considered that tight of a race, but things could get tight as we get closer to election day. And we do know Holcomb is a Republican. He locks lock and step with President Trump. President Trump has been calling for more things to open to not hurt the economy. And it in some quarters, people are thinking Governor Holcomb is he says he's looking at the science, but he may be feeling some of that political pressure.
And that's a lot different, Charlie, than what we've heard from Governor J.B. Pritzker as far as, 4% positivity rate in his mind is, still maybe too high.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, Illinois is still in what the governor refers to as stage four with quite a number of limitations. For example, he still has not yielded on the notion of letting high school kids play football this fall, despite a lot of pressure from parents and others. Yeah. We're still supposed to wear masks when we go out.
I was just going to mention, Charlie, you're talking about kids playing football. A lot of Illinois kids have been coming to Northwest Indiana to view high school football, both to support the high school teams, but also as a form of protest that, look, Indiana is reopened and Illinois not. But we're hoping in Indiana that doesn't come back to bite us with higher COVID-19 rates.
Yeah.
So when we talk about Northwest Indiana, especially where there's a lot of population right along the border there, of course, it feeds right into the Chicago region and the city of Chicago. And Hannah, when the Chicago area, for those of us who are downstate Illinois, Chicago was really the hotspot for the virus here at the beginning of the pandemic. But it appears things have stayed in check in recent weeks. This situation in Indiana could change that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely was at the beginning. And then when we got into late April, early May, we had this narrative, especially from downstaters saying, we're okay. It's just a Chicago problem. But of course, as time went on, and especially as the state went to a system where it was measuring by 11 smaller regions instead of the four big regions, what we actually saw was a lot of spikes downstate. We've talked about Region 4, the Metro East, seeing a spike, and finally those numbers are coming down, but not enough quite yet to see a removal of the restrictions that they've had since mid-August. And we also, I'm looking at Region 5, which is Southern Illinois. They've been very spiky, and lately in the kind of danger zone up to the 8% positivity trigger rate that would trigger more restrictions. But yeah, I mean, Chicago has held its rate down very steady in the 4-5% range for weeks and weeks. And so, if there was a spike in Indiana, especially Northwest Indiana, it could definitely seep into Chicago. And I think that's frankly what we saw in Region 4. And what the governor had done initially when the positivity rate in the Metro East had crept up was he said, okay, well, we have to kind of match what's across the river in Missouri. And then eventually he saw the numbers and said, actually that just isn't working. We have to, completely shut down indoor dining, indoor bar service. But of course, we're always going to have those across state lines dynamics, but it definitely, it's always going to be more evident when you have a big city on the border, like Chicago, like St. Louis.
Well, I did want to turn to another topic. When we talk the pandemic, of course, there's been the health concerns, but there's also been the economic reality. Many people out of work are struggling, a lot of them unable to pay their rent. And there's been a lot of worry there about evictions. Of course, we have seen an eviction moratorium that was put in place here in the state of Illinois. It was extended again just recently into late October. Michael, you've been reporting on this issue. Really, there's a couple of sides to this.
That's right, because for all the eviction moratoriums, it also affects the landlords. Now, I know the probably the popular notion is the big bad landlords, they have a lot of money to spend, or they could withstand this. Well, from my reporting, at least in Chicago, a lot of the landlords own maybe just one building. They own like a two or three flat. They've got a couple of tenants in there. And when those tenants aren't paying their rent, it's hard for the landlords to pay their mortgage on the property. And they're already predicting that there's going to be this sort of housing bubble explosion, but it's going to be similar to 2008, but this time it's going to affect the landlords who are unable to pay their mortgages. And this is everything from people who own condos in Chicago to people who own, say, two or three flats. If they don't get paid, it's a trickle down effect, and they're not getting any relief from the government.
Yeah, Charlie, it really comes back to, and I think the federal government especially, it really comes back to the need for some type of more comprehensive solution here, doesn't it?
I would think so, because as Michael said, landlords aren't just people who, you know, corporations that own some huge development with 150 units in it. They're people like when I lived in Chicago, and this is 50 years ago, I lived with my then spouse in an apartment on Geneva Terrace, which is a couple blocks west of Clark Street, and it was roughly a block north of Fullerton. We paid $250 a month. We were on the top floor. There was a third floor. The owners lived on the second floor, and there was a garden apartment in the basement. Now, that was what their income was. I mean, they had other jobs, but they would have been, with us, had we not paid our rent, they would have been in dire straits. So, yeah, there has to be some kind of a measure or some kind of a solution that would spare people being evicted and also provide cash flow for the landlords. And, of course, once the eviction moratorium is over, then people who have not paid their rent can be evicted, because the moratorium doesn't mean, oh, you don't have to pay the rent. It just means that your rent keeps piling up, and once this is over, you're obligated to pay the whole thing, or you can be evicted. Yeah. See, I think more needs to be done in this area.
And Michael, I know there's some money that has been set aside to help renters, and I think also for those with mortgages, but also it's probably not enough for the number of people who are finding themselves in this situation.
It's not enough, but the flip side to that, Sean, is also that renters have to be engaged in communication with their landlords. In some of the cases that I've been talking to the landlords, the tenant have just cut off all communications. So, and especially if it's a tenant that is causing problems, maybe there's drug use in the facility, they can't. It's even hard to evict troublesome tenants at this time. But when you cut off all communication with your landlord, I talked to a condo owner who, she used to live in Chicago. She left for a job in Colorado in HR. She lost her job. So she lost that income, and she's not getting the rent paid in her condo that she subleased. So now she has no money coming in. She's actually moved out to Brooklyn, New York to live with friends and family. So she's in a bind. She can't pay her mortgage on that condo, and the tenants have just cut off all communication. So it's a two-way street. Now, there is money put in there, but there has to be communication. But of course, there is not enough. And a lot of that money has already run out anyway.
Well, just a minute or so left here. And Hannah, I'm going to go back to you on something you covered this week. Some changes to what has been a pretty controversial process when it comes to marijuana dispensary licenses in Illinois. Remember that when the marijuana legalization measure passed in Illinois, there was going to be some opportunities to allow what you might consider underrepresented communities to, and some of those who've been hit by the war on drugs, to have an opportunity to partake in these types of opportunities to have licenses, marijuana dispensary licenses. It hasn't worked out that way yet. What changes are coming?
Right. So these first 75 of what are referred to as social equity dispensary licenses were supposed to have been awarded on May 1st, but the administration blamed COVID-19 and a bunch of other kind of issues in the weeds on the delays. And so when finally earlier in September, the finalists who are going to be put into a lottery, which was another thing that was added later, when kind of as like a, well, we didn't realize how many applications would come in, first of all, and how many applications would be tied with perfect scores. So what ended up happening is these 900 plus applicants who put in thousands of applications for dispensary licenses, turns out that only 21 individuals got into the lottery. And those are folks who submitted multiple applications. And so there's all this uproar of how did so few people get into the lottery? Was it that these extra points were awarded for if you're a veteran, and then that discounts a lot of people? And, you know, also some other reporting that's revealed that folks who were connected to KPMG, the massive accounting firm that got the no bid contract to even like score the applications, someone from that firm actually was connected to one of the potential winners. So after weeks of outrage and some protest and pressure on the governor's office, what they did was say, okay, we're going to allow you to have an opportunity to look at where you lost points. And then we understand that there are some discrepancies between how applications were scored. And so you have the opportunity to regain those lost points and get into the lottery. It's still not going to help the vast majority of folks who frankly are non-veterans, because those extra veterans points really put people over the edge, but it is something. And it was enough to make some folks who filed a federal lawsuit against the Pritzker administration, lawsuit that was actually pushed by some lawmakers, enough to make that lawsuit be dropped.
All right, let's go to our notes from the field. And Michael, go to you first.
Well, the one thing I'm looking at right now that I'm focusing on is, of course, we're all looking at who is President Trump's choice going to be for to replace Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It could be Barbara Lagoa. She's a Cuban-American U.S. appellate court judge. She's a native of Miami, Florida. And the reason that's important, of course, is because the all-important Latino vote. And believe it or not, Trump right now is gaining some momentum in Florida for attracting Latinos, despite his rhetoric. Democrats, Latinos can't imagine voting for Trump, but there are a number of Latino Trump supporters, and I've been reporting on that this afternoon for WBEZ. So it's interesting out there to see if Trump is going to be able to get more than 30% of the traditional Latino vote for Republicans. But despite some of his rhetoric, he remains very popular among Latinos in certain areas of the country.
And Hannah.
Yes, the other day, a interesting press release got into our inboxes, and I'll read it. Historic Anti-Corruption Alliance forged. Rod Blagojevich and Thomas McCullough joined to end Illinois corruption and unify our state. And it says, utilizing Rod Blagojevich's knowledge and experience, blah, 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 an anti-corruption roadmap. And we all know he has plenty of knowledge and experience with corruption.
That is true. That's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Michael Puente with WBEZ. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app. Production assistance for the program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.